For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
Hey everyone, Gil Gross here, post-match. We're going to go over a couple of Monte Carlo quarterfinals from today. Sinner versus Runa, Djokovic versus Demonor, and then I'll have quick thoughts on the semis. No full-blown preview, but I'll throw some thoughts out there, and then we will be on our merry way. But let's start with the first one. Sinner versus Runa, three-set win for Jannik, who advances to the Monte Carlo semis again. He's done something in back-to-back years now, which is really hard to do. Make the semis of Indian Wells, Miami, Monte Carlo, back to back to back. Since 1990, when they created the Masters Series, only the Big Four had done it. Only the Big Four. And now Sinner has done it 2 years in a row. So my predictions were mostly a mess for this tournament, but one thing that I did get right is that Sinner has shown in the past that he actually transitions Miami to Monte Carlo far better than most, and he's done it again here. He had to deal with, and this was a rematch of last year's Monte Carlo semifinal when Sinner lost to Runa 7-5 in the third. This was a very different Holger stylistically. Way more aggressive in his court positioning, taking every ball as early as possible. And that was the main way he was being aggressive, was just how much time he was stealing. Bigger, flatter hitting, yes. Playing closer to the lines, yes. Overall, just a way more proactive attacking style from Holger Rune compared to last year, where we saw not just at Monte Carlo, but over the course of the clay court season, Holger dropping back further behind the baseline, playing his forehand slower, higher, loopier, relying and trusting upon his defense, being really consistent, and toughing out those long rallies. I used to have to say, like, trust me, just believe me, because that's what I saw. But now with things like Tennis Insights in attack percentage, we actually get access to metrics where I can back myself up in the things I'm saying. And they did a side-by-side comparison of last year's Monte Carlo semifinal with Sinner and Runa and this year's quarterfinal. And it turns out that, first of all, last year, Sinner was in attack the majority of the time. It was 24% to 18% for Sinner. This year, it flipped. Runa was in attack a higher percentage of the time because he went from 18% in attack to 27% in attack. That was the change for Holger. Attacking way, way more. And I just want to contextualize those numbers. So last year, he was 18% in attack. This is the bottom 10 players on tour for in attack percentage in the last 52 weeks. Baez and Schwartzman. That's the kind of tennis Holger was playing a year ago. Baez and Schwartzman. And he beat Sinner that way. This year, up to 27%. That's not quite a top 10 number, because I'm showing you the top 10 now on the screen, and you can see it's players like Alis and Shelton, Cecchinato, which surprises me, Watanuki, Shapovalov, Karatsev. Jari, Eubanks, Raonic, Cressy. Reading off all the names, so those listening on the podcast will be able to enjoy this. But 27%, that's only a percentage and a half outside of the top 10 for in attack percentage. And that highlights kind of the change. Now, first I want to just keep it steady in terms of the flow. So first let's talk about why Holger changed, and then we'll get to Yannick and what he did about it. Did Runa implement this style because he needed to keep points short because he had to play two matches yesterday, including a three-set match that I think was like about 3.5 hours against Grigor Dimitrov? Maybe, but I thought he played similarly aggressively against Dimitrov. So doesn't fully explain it, especially when I think that Runa has been exceptionally aggressive consistently in the last 6 months. And I was curious to see, was he going to dial it back and kind of flip the switch when he hit the clay, going back to what he did last year during the clay court season, where like he beat Novak Djokovic playing as defensively and passively as I've ever seen him play. So in my opinion, it's something that worked for him, but he's gone away from it. Maybe it's the fatigue factor from the unfortunate and, you know, the scheduling circumstance, but I'm not fully convinced by that. I think it's kind of how he thinks he should play and how he wants to play right now. And do I think he is fully on the money there? Not positive, not really. I also think the physical side forces Runa's hand a lot of the time, because I continue to see that there's a lingering effect when he plays long rallies, that it affects his decision-making for the rest of the game. I do see a lot of heavy breathing, huffing and puffing after long rallies. Now, I think overall he held up quite well physically here, having to play three matches in a short time span. But I think that's when it comes to the long-term ability to maintain your game, I thought he was pretty good. But in the short term, the ability to maintain your game after a long rally, I'm not seeing him do that at a high level. I see the residue, the effects, affect his decision-making after long rallies, where I can almost see, oh, he might serve and volley here because he's tired. Bang, serve and volley on a second serve. Or I know he doesn't want to play a long point here. What do you know? First shot, drop shot, bang, right? So I see these things. Now, there were a lot of really good things that came from Runa's style in this match. He was an absolute shark on short balls. Because he was hugging the baseline, he was so well positioned to get on top of anything attackable and just take tons of time away and crush it. And he's so threatening off of the forehand and the backhand, so there's really nowhere to hide. The entire middle of the court is a kill zone for Runa. And that did make things hard on center. There's no doubt about it. What Yannick did was, first of all, get a lot of free points against a very aggressive return mindset. So because Runa wasn't returning tough and defending tough, and when I say tough, I mean how much are you willing to drop back and focus on making balls, even if you know you might have to do some running? That's what I mean by tough. Instead, especially even on the first serve return, I thought Holger's mindset was very offensive. He was not returning from all that deep in the court, and on the forehand especially, he was taking huge cuts. So Sinner got a lot of free points. What Yannick has done really well against this style of play consistently is accepting loss of agency, accepting loss of control, and not letting the pressure from that style of tennis make it so that Yannick starts playing more erratic, scratchier, more error-filled tennis. And that happens to a lot of players. When they go up against a Holger Runa who is threatening, standing right up on the baseline, crushing anything short, approaching the net, hitting drop shots, taking his backhand down the line hard all of these things that make you feel like you're under assault, like you're under pressure, right? In response to that, a lot of players go for more. They start pressing because they don't want to be attacked. But what Sinner has done such a good job of is not get defensive, not get passive, play the right shots over and over and over again, which means if there's an opportunity to counter, counter. If there's an opportunity to attack, attack. And if you're defending, be responsible and just try to play that extra ball as deep in the court as possible. And if you have a neutral ball, just play it back neutral, right? If there's no opening, just play it back neutral. So take what the situation suggests. That's why Sinner is keeping the unforced error count so low over and over and over again. At least it's one of the reasons. And I think the number in this match was 14 to 26 unforced errors. But you know what? I'm just going to check that real quick because I'm not positive. And I'm going to keep talking while I check it. And I'm going to use the Tennis TV number because that's the reliable one. It was 38 to 14. So 38 unforced errors for Runa, 14 for Sinner. It's the difference in the match. It highlights the difference in aggression, of course, because, obviously, as you would expect, Runa also hit more winners, 36 to 28. But boy, that's a huge disparity in unforced errors. So I talk about a lot of free points for Sinner, accepting the loss of control, continuing to play within yourself consistent and enjoying that advantage in steadiness. And also, you could see moments where Sinner took advantage of Runa's court position. And Dimitrov could do it a couple times as well. There's a trade-off there when Runa is standing as tight to the baseline as he was throughout this match. And those trade-offs are, If you're able to hit a lot of depth, you make Runa hit a half volley, and that can be tough. Holger, very impressive, very good on the rise on clay, which is not easy to do. But once he's hitting a half volley, it limits what he can do. And then the other thing is court coverage, right? Especially when Runa is pulled off the center line of the court and hits a ball hard cross court from inside the baseline. You could visualize in your head now, Holger is inside the baseline and he's hit the ball hard cross. The down the line is wide open if the redirect is possible. And yes, Holger is taking a lot of time away, and hitting the ball hard makes it hard to redirect the ball. But if Sinner is able to redirect, and he's very talented in doing so, he's able to get a lot of reward in instances that he does that. So all things considered, with all the free points that Sinner got, with the advantage in steadiness, Jannik rolled on serve throughout this match. He was never broken. And I also want to say, Dimitrov was only broken once in three sets against Holger Rune. But what Rune is doing is taking care of his serve with dynamic and really impressive first strike tennis. And he's winning tiebreaks. He's been extremely clutch. He won two tiebreaks against Dimitrov. He won a tiebreak here against Sinner. There's been timely first strike tennis and some dazzling shot making that I'm going to go over in a moment that kind of kept Holger in it here. Look at this tweet that was sent to me by HP Snack Attack here. It is a correlation between matches won percentage and tiebreaks won percentage. Now, there should be a positive correlation between matches won and tiebreaks won, because if you're a better player, you should also win more tiebreaks. And you can see that positive correlation play out. And most players are pretty close to this kind of median line that I drew across this the graph here. There are two outliers. There's Andrei Rublev, who, despite winning 65% of his matches, is only a 50-50 tiebreak player. And then the other outlier is Holger Rune, who wins, that's either 61 or 62% of his matches, but wins, it looks like 63 or 64% of his tie breaks. And by the way, it's harder to have a higher percentage of tie breaks won than matches won because the margins shrink because it's first to seven. So that's why you'll see lower win percentages for almost everybody in their tiebreak win percentages once the sample size gets large. Unless you are a sub 500 player, if you lose a lot of matches, then you're going to have a better record in tiebreaks because, again, it just gives you a better chance when the sample size shrinks, right? But look at Holger here. I mean, visually, this will play better for the YouTube crowd. This is really striking, Runo winning his tiebreaks at a high clip. You know, in this one, in the second set, he was down love 40 twice. And on both occasions, he rattled off five straight points. And both times, and this is remarkable, he never had to play more than a four-shot rally, which means serve plus one, never had to hit another shot in all 10 points that I'm talking about. So two love 40 comebacks in the second set, no points over four shots. This is Monte Carlo we're talking about. This isn't Turin, and he's playing Sinner. That's how dynamic his first strike was in this match against Dimitrov, who was really good as well. So that's impressive. And then there was some dazzling and audacious shot making where, you know, he saved the first match point with a running backhand down the line off of a really heavy and deep ball, forehand inside out, by Sinner. And somehow he redirected it to neutralize the point. It wasn't neutral for long, though, because Holger came back to his forehand and pummeled a slap shot, 95 mile per hour net grazer cross court for a winner. It was a forehand that throughout the match, there were a couple times where I saw Holger miss it in the back fence, miss it by 15 feet. And you're like, oh my God, it's like you didn't need to go for that. But he made it there. And then he made, you know, three great first serves down the stretch of the tiebreak. Sinner missed a neutral backhand on set point, the kind of neutral backhand that he never missed in Miami in that final. So it was a surprising miss. Sinner also missed some returns. He was a little bit tame on a couple of forehands. I'll tell you, the negative for Jannik here is that he got as nervous as I've ever seen him get, as tight as I've seen him get in the last like 6 months over this great stretch, right? But the second set, the fact that he lost it, that was a total gut punch. Love 40 twice, two match points, you lose it? That's a gut punch, and Sinner with the emotional composure, that's just remarkable that Jannik puts on display time and time again. These things happen to him in matches. It doesn't bother him the rest of the way, and he's still able to perform at an optimal level by putting whatever trauma just occurred in the match behind him very quickly. Now, as far as Rune's shot selection is concerned, the way he saved that match point was unbelievable, but then he kind of went for a similar attempt on the break point. He had a break point in the third set, in fact, the first of the set, and he went for a backhand drop shot 6-7 feet behind the baseline. So that's where it turns around on him. He got out of a lot of holes, going really, really big, being really, really fearless, but when he had a chance there, it went the other way, and he went for a shot that wasn't available because he was way too far back to hit a drop shot. Lost that break point and ended up losing the set and the match. So that's my overall take on the match. I'm just so curious to see what Rune does from here, because on one hand, it was a positive week because he makes the quarterfinal and he pushed Sinner. On the other hand, he's not really breaking serve and he's not really playing the style that saw him have so much success last year. So I don't really know what to make of it. Sinner moving on to the semis. I do want to, I guess, mention the officiating because it was a storyline. Although I kind of disagree with how much people were debating it and talking about it, other than the fact that in tennis we cling on to drama because there's not enough of it. Look, I disagree with the warning.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
That Damian Dumasuah issued at 5-all in the second set when Rune took an intentional time violation because he was trying to catch his breath, which I see him do a lot, usually at the end of sets. And then the crowd, for some reason, some people in the crowd started whistling or booing, which is pretty unreasonable, but Sinner is Italian and Monte Carlo is basically Italy. It's Monaco, but, you know, there's a lot of Italian support there. So there's Sinner supporters who are going to look for any reason to boo Holger. So that happened, right? And then Rune came back with this symbol, the talk symbol. I don't know what else to call it. And Damian Dumasuah gave him a warning for that. That's ridiculous. It's silly. I completely disagree with the warning. But am I going to... am I going to really lose a lot of sleep over it? Am I going to get super worked up over it? I'm not. And this comes right after last week where I did get pretty worked up about a missed call in Estoril that went against Nuno Borges because I thought it was a lot more consequential and a lot less of a judgment call and a much bigger mistake. But in this case, a warning is low stakes. And when something is low stakes like that, it incentivizes the umpires to be more liberal in terms of calling it. And it also should incentivize the players to brush it off because there's no immediate and direct consequence to a warning. A player should have an easier time, even if they disagree, saying whatever, just a warning and moving on. Rune sat down, called for the supervisor, had a conversation. Nothing came of it, obviously. And you know, I thought it was a silly warning, but it's really just not that big a deal. And then there was a line call that also went against Holger, which was even more unfortunate. But in this case, you know, Dumasuah comes out to check the mark. It was close. And electronic line calling, Hawkeye disagreed with Dumasuah's call, and it saw Sinner's ball out, but Dumasuah saw the mark in. This happens all the time. I'm not going to imply that, you know, Holger had this massive thing go against him that's completely unjust and unfair and terrible. This happens all the time on clay. This is just par for the course, my friends. It's going to happen 8 times a tournament where an umpire is going to read a mark differently than Hawkeye. The point is it's really close. There's a margin for error. And it's going to be interesting to see when electronic line calling is universal next year. How often are the players going to look at a mark and disagree with the system and say, no, the system's wrong. Look at the mark. So you don't get universal agreement on this kind of thing. Long story short, the officiating to me is a non-story in this match. Let's talk about Djokovic. Djokovic beats Demonor in straight sets. In a match that, I'm sorry, hate to say it, frankly, was kind of tough to watch at times just in terms of the quality. It was two players really struggling to execute their tennis, which can, you know, sometimes be fine, but I just thought it was a slog out there between both men just trying to figure things out. And Djokovic finds a way in straight sets. Now, the main thing that Novak was battling seemed to be his fitness, his cardio. He was gasping for air. He was doubled over. He was not even sitting up straight at the change of ends. Looked totally out of it at times in between points. And I continue to see And I understand why. Like, anytime you see this, it's a little bit jarring. It's like, whoa, what's wrong with Novak? You know, I think people who watch the channel know, like, this comes as no surprise to me, right? This is what I expect when Djokovic plays Monte Carlo, because I'm seeing it every single year. His cardio is not there yet. He likes to, I think, play into shape. So he plays a bunch of matches, and then he gets into shape gradually throughout the clay court season. The reason why it might not always be as apparent, or maybe it wasn't as apparent when he played Luca Nardi at Indian Wells, at least that's a slightly quicker surface, Nardi, an aggressive player, hitting his forehand big. The points weren't quite as long. Djokovic making unforced errors a lot of the time before the points could even get long. And we didn't really see the cardio stuff. But Monte Carlo, Alex de Minaur, right? This is one of the slowest courts in the world against a guy who's going to drag you into long rallies. Of course Novak's gasping for air. This is Monte Carlo. This is every single year this happens. So I'm not surprised. Now, the difference between this year, because Djokovic has advanced to the semifinals, and past years where he's failed to do so, is, I think, twofold. One, if I'm being honest, I don't think somebody has come up against Novak and delivered a really great performance. Okay? So if that happened, we may be talking about a whole different thing. But the second thing is, Djokovic is striking the ball really well. And that has not always been the case. There have been times where Novak has come to Monte Carlo and it's been, there's no cardio, there's no first serve, and there's no forehand. So now it's, you got to play rallies, you don't have that first serve plus one firepower, and you're playing on a slow clay court. So you got to play rallies and there's no cardio. Now there's a huge problem. But Djokovic has... first serve, de Minaur handled the first serve extremely well. So I'm not going to say Novak's first serve was a big factor, but the forehand was good. No, it missed too much, too many unforced errors, but it damaged. It had zip. He could play it close to the lines. He was confident hitting into the corners. Drop shot was money today. Djokovic's drop shot was a really good way for him to finish points. Now, the other thing was his willingness to suffer. That was a huge deal to me, because you could see that there were two versions of Djokovic. Excuse me, need to take a sip of water here. There was the version of Djokovic between the points who looked like a freaking zombie, okay? And then there was the Djokovic during the points who at times looked like a fatigued gladiator who was fighting for his life. The point being that despite Djokovic physically feeling it, he did not often make silly decisions or bail out of rallies prematurely. I thought there were instances in which his execution fell off because he didn't have his legs under him. That was making it difficult for him to get his feet in the right position or engage his legs on the ground stroke, or perhaps he was going for a hair too much. But it wasn't as if Djokovic was serve and volleying whenever he got tired, or hitting drop shots immediately whenever he got tired, or going for broke on backhands and forehands down the line. He was playing pretty responsible tennis despite clearly hurting in both the lungs and maybe even the legs. So Djokovic's warrior mentality and willingness to suffer was a major reason why he was able to find a way through this match. Now, for me, de Minaur played an absolute clunker. His game plan, I think, was to make the match physical, to try to utilize a cardio advantage, which he did indeed have, but he was way too erratic and made far too many errors for that game plan to play out, because he certainly didn't play with a lot of at least effective aggression. He really struggled to finish at net, got passed a lot, couldn't really find his way up there. Forehand wasn't really penetrating. Drop shot execution, pretty poor. So And it was mostly a mess for Demonor trying to attack, but he didn't try to attack that often either. It was really kind of a let's see if we can wear Novak down kind of strategy. And it was sloppy in the way he was implementing it, right? Five all in the first set, he made five unforced errors in that game. Djokovic was not made to win a single point that wasn't a pretty cheap Demonor unforced error, which included two double faults, which brings me to the Demonor serve, which was MIA, 42% first serves in for the match. Demon doesn't have a big second serve. So if that's another thing. If you look at why couldn't Demonor play a lot of tennis on his front foot, why couldn't he dictate against Djokovic very often in this match? Well, certainly it doesn't help if you don't make first serves. So I just felt like he was not making Djokovic run enough. He was missing too much. He was struggling to measure distance on his backhand. A lot of backhands long. Struggled with his drop shot, as I mentioned. It just, nothing was clicking. Now, Novak did finish with a flourish, played, in my opinion, his best return game, despite breaking serve quite a bit. In my view, his best return game was 4-5 in the second, where Novak did play a really good game. He had a good forehand cross court that threw Demonor off balance, stepped in, followed it up with a nice backhand drop shot for a winner on the next point. Demonor went to the drop shot. I thought it was a pretty good one. Djokovic got there, kept two hands on the racket, flicked a backhand cross court for a winner. 15-30, he made a pretty good second serve return. I'd say probably an unforced error off the first ball backhand from Demonor, but you know, applied some pressure on the second serve return, and then at 15-40, another second serve look, pushed Demon back on the return, hit a big inside-out forehand to force the error. So Novak won a lot in that return game on his own terms. And ultimately, I think he should feel good, despite being at less than his best, about playing buttoned up on the big points and finding ways to win at less than 100%. Really good for his psyche, really good for his fitness to get in as many matches as he's will be able to get in over the course of Monte Carlo, because ultimately that's what's going to get him back into form. And, you know, I think regardless of what happens from here on out, to me, it's been a successful Monte Carlo for Djokovic. With that said, let's talk about these semifinals just a little bit. Tsitsipas versus Sinner is an interesting head-to-head. It's the head-to-head that ultimately forced Sinner to fire Ricardo Piatti and bring on Darren Cahill and Simone Vignosi after losing to Sinner, or after losing to Tsitsipas at the Australian Open in 2023. That's when Sinner decided to make that change. Since then, Yannick has won both meetings. They were last year. It was 6-4, 6-3 in Rotterdam. It was 6-4, 6-4 at the Nitto ATP Finals. So psychologically, I think Yannick takes a lot of pride in this head-to-head because it was so difficult for him when he was young. And I think Tsitsipas, who has played really well here at Monte Carlo, and he's a two-time champion, I think the key for him to win, he needs to have the best first serve on the court and the best forehand on the court. And if he can do that, he's got the better first serve and the better forehand, I think that maybe he can dominate with the first strike tennis enough, as Holger was kind of able to do against Sinner a little bit, to kind of tip the scales in his favor and use his scrambling ability, his athleticism to get in some return games, try to work out some breaks of serve from there. But if he doesn't have the better first serve and the better forehand, and they play more from neutral, that's where you just look at the backhand and backhand battle, and you're very concerned for Tsitsipas, and you don't really feel that he's going to be able to really do anything about that. I think Sinner needs to really do a good job of attacking Tsitsipas' backhand return creatively. I think if Tsitsipas backs up on the ad side, Sinner should serve and volley. I think Sinner should mix in the first ball drop shot to not let Tsitsipas kind of work his way back into the points after his kind of heavy return of serve. So I'm leaning center and three for that one. As for Djokovic Ruud, that's a 5-0 head-to-head for Djokovic, and I think this is Casper's best chance to beat Novak. If Novak doesn't play better than he has so far, I think Casper will win. Full stop. I think Casper will win. However, my gut is that Djokovic plays the best match he's played of the week. I think he's going to be able to point shorten with net rushing against Ruud, as he usually is able to do quite successfully. I think he'll be able to go hard into Casper's forehand and actually get some errors out of Ruud's weapon, which he does extremely well. And I think the clarity, the tactical clarity that Djokovic usually gains out of playing Ruud, combined with the fact that I think Novak is hitting the ball well, might make it so that the physical stuff is, again, something that Novak is able to overcome. Maybe, I don't know, maybe not. If you're Casper, what you want to do is you want to play a lot of points where you're controlling the middle of the court with your forehand and not necessarily even finishing on, like, he should pull an Andre Agassi almost, which it's hard to do this on command, but if you're Ruud and you can play a lot of dictating tennis, because once the ball gets on your forehand, you kind of never let your opponent off the hook, which he does extremely well as kind of anyone since Nadal and team, really, on clay. He might be able to just deliver enough body blows to take it out of Djokovic's legs and once again get Novak to a place where he's just hurting physically, and then, you know, make less errors than Musetti and De Minaur did, particularly under pressure. That would be the blueprint for Ruud. I'm going to go Djokovic in three. I still, it's bizarre. Like, I still don't think Novak's going to win Monte Carlo. I think whoever wins the Tsitsipas Sinner final will end up winning the tournament. But those are my reads on the semifinals. There's not going to be any coverage tomorrow. I am busy, but I will talk to you for Monday match analysis after the Monte Carlo final. Hope you enjoyed. Don't forget to subscribe. I'll see you next time.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.